A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a big one. He's asking about the fundamental tension in infrastructure, roads, fiber, power lines. These are natural monopolies because digging them in costs a fortune, but we want competition on top of them. His question is whether Israel's model of forcing infrastructure owners to lease access at regulated rates can work elsewhere, and how regulators actually prevent the network owner from strangling the virtual operators that depend on them. He's essentially asking, can you force a monopoly to host its own competition, and have it actually work?
The timing on this is almost too perfect. The EU's Gigabit Infrastructure Act just took effect this month, May 2026, and it's essentially trying to answer exactly this question across 27 countries at once. Meanwhile, the FCC has been tinkering with its own versions. This is not some abstract regulatory philosophy seminar. Every time a city digs up a street for fiber, it costs about $500,000 per mile in urban areas. And we're doing it five times because five different companies buried their own glass. Those two things pull in opposite directions.
Because the obvious free market answer, let three companies each lay their own fiber, is insane.
Infrastructure like fiber optic networks or electricity grids has what economists call high fixed costs and low marginal costs. Digging the trench, laying the conduit, pulling the glass, that's enormously expensive. But once it's in the ground, the cost of lighting up one more customer is close to zero. That's the textbook definition of a natural monopoly.
The argument goes, why would anyone build a second one? And if nobody builds a second one, you've got a monopoly. End of story.
And for decades, the solution was to just regulate the monopoly directly. Set prices, set service standards, yell at them when they misbehave. The problem is that regulated monopolies are still monopolies. They don't innovate on customer experience. They don't compete on price. They get comfortable. The insight behind infrastructure sharing is that you can separate the physical layer from the service layer.
Which sounds almost socialist, until you realize it was born in the Reagan era, in the context of breaking up the Bell system.
This isn't some fringe regulatory theory, it's mainstream competition law. The essential facilities doctrine says you can own the bridge, but you have to let other people drive across it at a fair toll.
Let's look at a country that actually tried to solve this. Israel, starting in 2018, what actually happened?
The court essentially said, if you control a facility that's essential for competitors to do business, and it's not practical for them to duplicate it, you can be compelled to provide access on reasonable terms. AT&T controlled the local telephone exchanges. MCI wanted to offer long-distance service but couldn't physically reach customers without going through those exchanges. The court said, you have to let them in. And this wasn't a suggestion. These were regulated, cost-based wholesale rates.
IVC is interesting here because it wasn't the legacy player. It was the challenger that had to share too.
Israel's 2015 telecom reform is probably the cleanest example in the world of this doctrine applied aggressively and successfully. Here's what happened. The Ministry of Communications looked at the broadband market and saw that Bezeq, the incumbent former state monopoly, controlled about 95% of the fixed line infrastructure.
Let's talk about what passive infrastructure actually means here, because the distinction matters.
Passive infrastructure is the stuff that just sits there. The ducts under the street, the dark fiber, which is fiber optic cable that's been laid but has no transmission equipment attached to it yet. The regulator stepped in and said, here are the new rules. Bezeq and IBC both have to offer wholesale access to their physical infrastructure at regulated rates.
The separation between these two is what makes the whole model work.
We're talking about duct access, the actual physical conduit in the ground, and dark fiber, which is the unlit glass strands that the virtual operator can connect their own equipment to. Bezeq had to create a separate subsidiary, Bezeq Infrastructure, that manages all the passive stuff and must offer access to every licensed ISP at uniform, cost-oriented prices. The retail arm of Bezique has to buy access from Bezique Infrastructure on exactly the same terms as 012 Smile or Partner or Cellcom.
The retail arm can't get a sweetheart deal from its own infrastructure sibling.
So if it cost Bezique 42 shekels per month to maintain the infrastructure per subscriber, they could charge virtual operators 45 shekels. That's about $12. The idea is you calculate what it would cost an efficient operator to build and maintain the network over its lifetime. Add a return on capital that's high enough to incentivize continued investment, and that's your wholesale price.
As of 2025, wholesale dark fiber access in Tel Aviv is running somewhere around 45 to 60 shekels per meter per year, depending on density.
Which is transparent and predictable. Any virtual operator can look at that rate sheet and build a business model around it. They don't have to negotiate individually with Bezique and hope they get a fair deal. The price is the price.
What's the result been in terms of actual consumer pricing?
Israel's retail fiber prices dropped roughly 40% between 2019 and 2025. And that's not just introductory teaser rates. That's sustained price compression driven by genuine competition. You've got companies like 012 Smile, Partner, Cellcom, and others all competing on price, customer service, value-added services, static IPs, bundled TV packages, business-grade SLAs, and none of them had to dig up a single street.
40% is the kind of number that makes incumbent shareholders weep and regulators frame on their wall.
Here's the thing that critics always raise. Doesn't this kill the incentive to invest? If you have to share your network at cost, plus, why would you bother building it in the first place?
The answer is in the plus.
The LRIC plus model includes a capital cost allowance. The regulated rate of return is designed to be attractive enough to fund upgrades. And the evidence bears this out. Israel's fiber coverage went from about 30% of households to 85% after the sharing mandate was implemented. New Zealand's Chorus invested 2.5 billion New Zealand dollars in fiber upgrades between 2018 and 2025 while operating under open access rules. The investment didn't dry up.
Because the infrastructure owner now has a guaranteed customer base, every virtual operator is a revenue stream. You're not competing for retail customers. You're collecting wholesale fees from everyone.
Those wholesale revenues are more predictable than retail revenues, which is something investors actually like.
Now there's a complication here that most people don't think about until they're standing in their apartment building staring at a locked telecom closet. What happens when the building's internal wiring is already owned by the first ISP that got there?
This is the last mile inside the building problem. In a lot of countries, the first ISP to wire an apartment building effectively owns the in-building infrastructure, and they have no obligation to let competitors use it. So you get this absurd situation where the street-level sharing works beautifully, but the final 50 meters inside the building are still monopolized.
Israel's solution.
A building access regulation. Property owners are required to allow any licensed ISP to install their own in-building wiring at no cost to the building. The ISP bears the installation cost. The building owner can't say no, and they can't charge a fee.
Which means, if you're in a Tel Aviv apartment and you want to switch from Bezique to Partner, Partner can run their own fiber from the street into your unit without the landlord blocking it.
They don't have to rewire the whole building. They just need a path to the specific units that are switching. Over time, you end up with multiple ISP's fibers running through the building risers, and switching becomes a software change.
Let's talk about a concrete example that shows what happens without this kind of regulation. Tel Aviv's Rothschild Boulevard.
Oh, this one hurts. Between 2015 and 2020, three separate fiber ducts were laid under Rothschild Boulevard, one by Bezique, one by IBC, one by IVC. Each trench cost roughly $200,000 per kilometer. So that's $600,000 per kilometer to put three sets of glass in the ground that could have been one shared duct with three times the fiber strands inside it.
Every time they dug it up, the boulevard was a construction zone. Restaurants lost business. Traffic was a nightmare. The city had to repave each time.
Under the sharing mandate, one duct would have been sufficient. Any ISP could lease dark fiber strands inside that shared duct. The infrastructure cost gets amortized across multiple retail providers, and the street gets dug up once.
The triple dig is the perfect metaphor for everything wrong with unregulated infrastructure competition.
It would mean that if someone wanted to build a neighborhood microgrid or a community solar installation, the incumbent distribution network would have to lease them space on the poles at cost plus 7. Bezeq wanted to charge a premium for higher speed access, arguing that 10 gig symmetric required different handling at the infrastructure level. Right, and that's why the analogy isn't perfect. Electricity has physics constraints that fiber doesn't, but the principle still applies in specific contexts.
Which is technically true.
Article 3 requires any utility, power, water, gas, sewer, to grant access to their physical infrastructure for fiber deployment at cost-oriented rates. So if the electric company has poles or ducts, they have to let fiber companies use them.
Which is exactly the kind of behavior that reveals the monopoly instinct lurking under the surface.
The regulator resolved it by imposing a temporary 15% price cut on the wholesale rate and clarifying that dark fiber pricing must be based on the physical characteristics of the fiber, length, strand count, duct space, not on what the retail ISP plans to do with it.
The Israeli model works well for fiber, but the prompt asks how this applies to other infrastructure networks. Let's start with energy.
The EU is essentially saying, we're not going to let each utility dig its own trench when the trenches are already dug. The distribution network operators own the poles and wires. The retail suppliers buy access to those networks and sell electricity to consumers.
There's a complication in energy that fiber doesn't have. Electrons don't have lanes.
Altice, the incumbent in Portugal, went to virtual operators and said, we're going to build fiber to 95% of the country. If you want in, you pay 30% of the build costs up front, and in exchange, you get a 15-year wholesale contract at favorable rates.
The virtual operators become part owners of the infrastructure, not just tenants. They've got skin in the game.
The results are instructive. Portugal hit 95% fiber coverage by 2024. That's extraordinary. One of the best covered countries in Europe. But retail prices only dropped about 25%, compared to Israel's 60%.
You trade price competition for build-out speed. The virtual operators got cheap enough wholesale rates to offer some discount, but they'd already sunk 30% of the capital cost, so they weren't going to start a price war.
And this is the core trade-off in infrastructure regulation. Cost plus wholesale with a price squeeze test, the Israel model, maximizes retail competition and price reduction. Co-investment, the Portugal model, maximizes build-out speed and coverage. Neither is objectively better. It depends on what problem you're trying to solve.
If you're Israel in 2015, your problem is a 95% monopoly with terrible speeds and high prices. You need competition fast.
That's the power of structural separation. The infrastructure is a platform. The retailers are apps running on that platform. When an app fails, users move to a different app. The platform doesn't care.
What about water? The prompt mentioned that too.
These aren't technical details. They're the parameters that determine whether the whole system works or becomes a paper tiger.
Let me poke at one thing. You mentioned that Israel's fiber coverage went from 30 to 85%, but that's still not 100. Who are the 15% that didn't get fiber, and why?
And it gets at one of the genuine limitations of the wholesale model. The 15% are mostly in rural areas and smaller peripheral communities where the cost per household is much higher. The wholesale model works beautifully in dense urban areas where the cost per subscriber is low and the virtual operators are eager to compete. But in a small town in the Galilee or the Negev, the economics are different.
They apply the essential facilities doctrine to desalinated water.
Early results from the Antofagasta region show about a 12% drop in industrial water prices, but there's been ongoing conflict over maintenance cost allocation. That's where you need supplementary policy, universal service obligations, rural subsidies, public-private partnerships. The wholesale model isn't a magic wand. It's a market mechanism, and markets go where the returns are.
That seems solvable with metering, though.
In principle, yes. In practice, water metering at the wholesale level is less precise than electricity metering, and the disputes have been genuine. Chile's water regulator has spent the last few years essentially building the administrative infrastructure to adjudicate these allocation questions.
The model transfers, but the implementation complexity varies by sector. Fiber is the cleanest case. Energy adds congestion. Water adds both congestion and measurement challenges.
There's a lesson here about sequencing. You don't try to solve all of it on day one. You establish the structural separation, set cost-based wholesale pricing, create a dispute resolution mechanism, and then iterate as problems emerge.
Let's talk about a scenario where the infrastructure owner tries to sabotage the model from within. Specifically, what prevents them from degrading service quality for virtual operators' customers?
This is the repair ticket problem. You're a virtual operator, one of your customers reports an outage, you file a ticket with the infrastructure owner, and that ticket goes to the bottom of the queue while the infrastructure owner's own retail customers get priority.
Which is exactly what happened in New Zealand.
In 2023, 2Degrees alleged that Chorus, which is the infrastructure spin-off from Telecom New Zealand, was prioritizing its own retail arms repair tickets. The Commerce Commission investigated and imposed what they called a functional separation audit regime with quarterly reporting. Chorus now has to publicly report on repair times, broken down by whether the customer belongs to their own retail arm or to a competitor.
The mere existence of that reporting requirement changes behavior.
Nobody wants to be the executive explaining to a regulator why competitor tickets take twice as long as internal tickets. The transparency is the enforcement mechanism.
New Zealand is actually the other poster child for this model, alongside Israel. What does their setup look like?
New Zealand took an even more radical approach than Israel. They didn't just mandate sharing, they structurally separated Telecom New Zealand into two completely independent companies. Chorus owns all the passive infrastructure and operates as a regulated monopoly wholesaler. Spark is the retail company. They have no common ownership. And as of early 2026, Chorus supports over 150 retail ISPs on its network.
150? That's not a market with three competitors fighting over scraps. That's genuine retail competition.
The results speak for themselves. New Zealand's broadband prices dropped 35% from 2018 to 2025, while average speeds tripled. You had more competition and more investment simultaneously, which is exactly what the skeptics said couldn't happen.
Let's bring in the U.S. context, because the contrast is instructive.
The U.S. is a patchwork. The EFCC's 2024 digital discrimination rules include language about network access on reasonable terms, but they lack the structural separation that makes the Israeli and New Zealand models work. Without structural separation, you're essentially asking the infrastructure owner to please be nice to competitors, and hoping the threat of enforcement keeps them honest.
Which it won't. Which it won't.
It hasn't. The BEAD program, Broadband Equity Access and Deployment, is funding publicly owned middle-mile networks in 14 states. That's a different approach. Rather than forcing private owners to share, you build public infrastructure and make it open access by default.
The last mile is still the problem.
The middle mile is the easier part because it's essentially long-haul fiber between population centers. The last mile is the expensive part, getting from the neighborhood node to every individual home. And in most of the U.S., that last mile is still controlled by a handful of incumbent ISPs with no obligation to share.
14 states have publicly owned middle mile, and 0 states have mandated last mile sharing.
Cost Plus, with the price squeeze test, the Israel model, maximizes retail competition and consumer benefit. Co-investment, the Portugal model, maximizes build-out speed. You have to choose based on what your market most urgently needs.
The second parameter is the separation model. Functional separation with separate management, separate IT, separate offices. That's what prevents sabotage.
This is the copper retirement problem, and it's a critical safeguard. BZeek wanted to shut down its copper network to force customers onto its fiber, where it had, at the time, less regulated wholesale obligations. For consumers, here's the actionable insight. In markets with mandatory infrastructure sharing, look for virtual operators that use the same physical network as the incumbent.
Because otherwise, the infrastructure owner can use the transition to new technology as a window to reestablish monopoly control.
In Israel, you can get gigabit fiber from a virtual operator for about 70 shekels a month, $20, when the same speed from BZeek retail might cost 110 shekels. Same fiber, same reliability, different logo, 40% cheaper.
In the US, it's worth checking whether your address is served by a competitive local exchange carrier. These are the CLECs that lease from the incumbent. The coverage is spotty, but where they exist, the price difference can be substantial.
Which is hard. Regulators are inherently slower than the companies they regulate, but the Israeli case shows it's possible if you establish the principle up front. Any new infrastructure inherits the sharing obligations of the old infrastructure. For investors, the insight is counterintuitive but important. Infrastructure sharing reduces the risk of stranded assets.
Let's talk about the European dimension, since there's a major regulatory shift happening right now.
That makes the asset more financeable, not less. It mandates duct and pole access across all member states, essentially requiring every EU country to implement a version of what Israel and New Zealand have been doing. The act also streamlines permit processes and requires new buildings to be pre-wired with fiber and open access in-building infrastructure.
The EU is essentially codifying the Israeli model at continental scale.
If you're an investor looking for growth, this is a yield play, not a growth play. That creates a risk of regulatory arbitrage, where infrastructure owners lobby for favorable pricing models in individual countries.
The principle of mandated access is now EU law.
Israel's fiber deployment accelerated after mandatory sharing was introduced. The mechanism is that wholesale obligations create guaranteed revenue streams that make infrastructure projects bankable.
Second, infrastructure sharing means everyone gets the same service. This confuses the physical layer with the service layer. Virtual operators running on dark fiber control their own equipment.
The evidence from the early adopters doesn't support that. New Zealand's Chorus invested $2.5 billion New Zealand dollars over 7 years under open access. Israel's fiber coverage exploded after the sharing mandate. Third, the incumbent will always find ways to sabotage the virtual operators. This one has some truth to it. The incentives for sabotage are real. But functional separation, properly enforced SLAs, and a regulator with teeth can prevent it.
Which is actually a more diversified and stable revenue base.
Instead of 100% of your revenue coming from your own retail operation, you've got revenue from every ISP in the market. If one of them stumbles, your infrastructure revenue doesn't crater.
That requires ongoing regulatory oversight and enforcement. The model works, but it's not cheap or easy to maintain.
That's the honest trade-off. Infrastructure sharing with functional separation requires a capable, well-funded regulator. In countries with weak regulatory institutions, the model is much harder to implement. The rules might exist on paper, but without enforcement, the incumbent will find ways around them.
Which brings us to a question I think is open. As AI and edge computing drive demand for symmetric gigabit connections, upload speeds matching download speeds, will the current sharing models be sufficient?
Or push your municipal government? Some cities are now requiring open access in-building wiring as a condition of construction permits for new buildings and major renovations. If you're in a condo association or a tenant group, this is something you can actually organize around.
There's also an investor angle here that's worth flagging. Infrastructure sharing reduces the risk of stranded assets.
A single shared fiber network has a more predictable revenue stream than competing networks. If you're an investor looking at Israeli infrastructure companies, Bezeq Infrastructure and IBC trade at lower betas than their integrated peers in markets without sharing mandates. The regulatory framework provides revenue certainty.
Lower beta, more predictable cash flows, less risk of a competitor overbuilding you.
It's counterintuitive if you're used to thinking a monopoly control is the safest investment, but monopolies attract regulation, and regulation can be unpredictable. A regulated wholesale monopoly with guaranteed access fees is actually more stable than an unregulated monopoly that's constantly fighting off competitors and regulators.
What does this mean for someone who actually has to build or regulate one of these systems? What are the actionable pillars?
First, structural or functional separation of infrastructure from retail. You can't have the same entity owning the pipes and selling the service, because the incentive to discriminate is too strong. Functional separation. Separate subsidiaries with separate management and audited arms. Links dealing is the minimum. Structural separation, entirely separate companies, is better. Cost-based wholesale pricing with a transparent LRIC model. The formula has to be public, auditable, and include a capital cost allowance that funds continued investment. If the wholesale price is too low, the infrastructure degrades. If it's too high, competition doesn't materialize. Getting this number right is the single most important design parameter.
The third pillar.
A regulator with teeth. Specifically, the power to audit service quality, impose price caps when the formula breaks down, mandate network upgrades, and block anti-competitive behavior like premature copper retirement. Without enforcement capability, the first two pillars are just suggestions.
A suggestion-based regulatory framework. The libertarian compromise that satisfies no one.
It's worse than nothing, because it creates the appearance of regulation without the substance, which makes it harder to build political momentum for real reform.
Even with all these tools in place, there's a looming question that keeps regulators up at night.
AI-driven bandwidth demand. Data center traffic is projected to grow at about 25% compound annual growth rate through 2030. That's not incremental. That's a step change in infrastructure requirements. And the question is whether the LRIC Plus wholesale pricing model can generate enough revenue to fund the massive investment that kind of growth requires.
Because LRIC Plus is designed for steady-state infrastructure growth, not exponential demand curves.
The model assumes you're adding capacity at a predictable rate. If AI training and inference suddenly require 10 times the fiber capacity in certain corridors, the wholesale pricing formula might not generate enough revenue fast enough to fund that build-out.
Which leads to the two-tier question. Do we end up with a system where premium customers pay for dedicated fiber, while everyone else shares the regulated wholesale network?
It's already happening in a limited way. Some large financial institutions lease dedicated dark fiber for ultra-low latency trading connections. They're not on the shared wholesale network. They've essentially built their own parallel infrastructure for specific high-value routes.
If that model expands, you risk undermining the whole premise of infrastructure sharing. The highest value customers peel off onto private networks, leaving the shared network with a less profitable customer base, which makes the LRIC math harder to sustain.
That's the tension. Infrastructure sharing works best when everyone is on the shared network. The more exceptions you create, the more the economics of the shared network deteriorate.
The next frontier here is wireless. Can the same model work for 5G small cells and radio access networks?
The O-RAN Alliance published specifications in 2025 that include APIs for shared radio access network infrastructure. The idea is that multiple mobile virtual network operators could share the same physical radios and antennas with software-defined slicing to allocate capacity.
Commercial adoption so far?
The specifications exist on paper, but no major operator has deployed a fully shared RAN in production. The technical challenges are significant. Interference management, quality of service guarantees, real-time resource allocation, and the incumbent equipment vendors have every incentive to slow-walk the standardization process.
Because they make more money selling dedicated hardware to each operator.
Of course they do. A shared infrastructure model for wireless would be the equivalent of what happened in fiber, and the Nokias and Ericssons of the world are not eager to see their hardware sales divided by the number of operators sharing each cell site.
The fiber model is proven, and scaling. Energy is more complex but operational in multiple countries. Water is nascent but promising, and wireless is still a regulatory aspiration with no commercial reality.
That's the landscape, and the through line in every sector is the same. You need structural separation, transparent cost-based pricing, and a regulator willing to enforce the rules when the infrastructure owner inevitably tests the boundaries.
The prompt asks how regulators ensure fair terms for virtual operators. The answer, across every case study we've looked at, is that they don't ensure it through goodwill. They ensure it through architecture. You design the system so that discrimination is hard, visible, and punished.
You keep designing. The infrastructure owner will always find new ways to advantage its own retail arm. The regulator's job is to stay close enough to the operational details to spot those moves and close the gaps before they become structural advantages.
Which requires a regulatory agency that's technically sophisticated, adequately funded, and politically insulated enough to make unpopular decisions.
That last part is the hardest. Infrastructure owners are usually large, politically connected, and skilled at framing their interest as the national interest. The regulator needs enough independence to say no to a company that employs thousands of people and sponsors the local football team.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In 1813, a French naturalist in the Solomon Islands discovered that fossilized tree resin from the region's ancient kauri forests produces a distinct acoustic ringing when struck, a property caused by the resin's unusually high degree of molecular cross-linking, which essentially turn the fossil into a natural glass that resonates at frequencies inaudible to the human ear, but detectable by bats.
Bats can hear fossils.
That's a sentence I didn't expect to process today.
This has been my Weird Prompts. I'm Korn.
I'm Herman Poppleberry. If you want more episodes like this one, find us at myweirdprompts.com or search for My Weird Prompts wherever you listen. Rate us if you feel like it.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My Weird Prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My Weird Prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.